Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I want to talk about the concept of compromise and compromising, where so many people just give in, knuckle under, until there's nothing left to compromise with because they've given themselves away. I'm going to talk about a few historical examples of people who did not give in, people who stuck firm to their beliefs, to their convictions, and made history, created their own destiny, because they did not compromise. What I see today is endless amounts of compromising, people knuckling under over and over again, not calling out lies, not calling out BS when it's there in front of them, and having to suffer the indignity of being around a bunch of stupid, ignorant people who think they know better than anyone else when they're just fools, matrix sentinels. The first person I'm going to talk about is Desmond Doss. Some of you may be familiar with him. I only recently found out about him watching Mel Gibson's movie, Hacksaw Ridge. Hacksaw Ridge was the nickname that American soldiers from the 96th Division called what was known as the Maeda Escarpment. The Maeda Escarpment, named after the village of Maeda. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Desmond Doss was a Seventh-day Adventist. As such, he had a fervent belief in the Bible. He would not work on the seventh day, and he was a conscientious objector during World War II, beginning in his early training days, because from his understanding of Scripture, you can't kill people, okay? So he was a conscientious objector, and you can imagine how this went over with the people in his unit. He was bullied, he was harassed. Over and over again, the superiors in his army unit, so-called superiors, tried to bounce him out. They wanted him to quit. They wanted him to just go away. And then when he wouldn't go away, when he said, look, I don't have to carry a weapon, I can be a medic, I don't have to kill somebody, I can still help my fellow soldiers by helping them on the battlefield, I'll be a medic, I just won't carry weapons. That wasn't good enough. He was hectored, he was bullied, he was even threatened. Some of his fellow soldiers said, when we go into combat, I'm going to kill you, they told this guy. They thought he was a redneck, they thought he was a pacifist. You have to understand the racial stereotyping of the time, where the Japanese were reduced to inhuman, subhuman, demonic status by the propagandists. The war in the Pacific was an inherently racial war. You have to understand that from both directions. The Japanese, because of their Shinto religion and their belief in the emperor, and the emperor being descended from the sun goddess, that the emperor was divine, and people from the Southlands were regarded as hairy barbarians to the Japanese, right, going way back. And then, of course, the Americans with their own stereotypes. The Japanese were bandy-legged, idiots that, looked out of Coke bottle rim glasses and couldn't shoot straight and were buck-toothed and, all these racial stereotypes you can imagine. So the Pacific War was a war steeped in hatred. And, of course, it's too long to get into, but by deliberately allowing and, in fact, goading the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor, leaving it as a kind of a sitting duck place with all the battleships, that instilled this hatred in the Americans and the combat soldiers in the Pacific, Marines, and soldiers. So the notion that someone like Desmond Doss would not be armed, and, oh, by the way, on the seventh day of the week, I'm not going to do anything, I'm not going to work, I'm not going to do anything because my beliefs say I can't do that. Anyway, long story short, he proves himself in combat. He proves himself on Guam. He proves himself elsewhere in the Pacific, and culminating in the Battle of the Maida Escarpment, where the Japanese launched a vicious counterattack. You have to understand that Okinawa was Japanese territory for a long time. They've had decades to develop all kinds of underground tunnel systems, quite comprehensive tunnel systems. The Japanese have been using caves and tunnel systems in warfare against the Americans and the Australians since at least the Biak operation, is a large island off of New Guinea. And then later on, as the Central Pacific Offensive continued under Admiral Nimitz in particular, the Japanese made frequent use of natural cavern systems. They developed their own tunnel systems. And this was ex especially the case in Okinawa, where there was miles and miles of underground tunnel systems, where they would have large numbers of soldiers underground that could pop up at any time, anywhere, to the left, to the right, in front of, behind the American troops on Okinawa. And they would be able to muster these troops very quickly. Long story short, they launched a counterattack against the American army on the Maida Escarpment, aka Hacksaw Ridge, and drove off the soldiers. They had to climb down large cargo nets to get down off the escarpment. Well, Desmond Doss stayed behind, and what he would do was he would go around this battlefield at night and during the day. And remember, he's not armed, right? He doesn't even want to carry a knife because it's, violence is against his nature. This is the same guy that was bullied, the same guy who was threatened, the same guy who was harassed by his so-called superiors because of his fervent beliefs. So what happens? Desmond Doss goes around, finds these wounded American soldiers, hauls them over to the edge of the cliff, ties a knot around them with a rope, and then lowers the wounded soldier down to the ground, where American soldiers down there untie the wounded person. And then Desmond Doss would say to himself out loud sometimes, "Lord, let me find just one more," right? And he would go off, and then he would find another wounded soldier, and then he would bring him back to the edge of the cliff, tie a rope around him, lower him down. You can imagine the stress and the strain of not only having to find wounded soldiers, but do so and avoid getting shot and killed by the Japanese. Just the artillery alone that the Japanese were able to call down in on Okinawa was stupendous, let alone their ability to pop out of caves and tunnels at any moment, let alone the roving Japanese patrols that were on the surface. Yet time and again, he would go back, he would say, "Lord, let me find one more," right? And there's all those esoteric types out there. There's all those ho truthers out there. "Lord, Lord, he's invoking Enki, he's invoking Lucifer, this, that." These self-righteous twits, right? Who learn just enough to be annoying. Anyway, Desmond Doss would go out there, find another soldier, bring him back, wounded, bring back another wounded soldier, tie another knot around him, lower him all the way to the ground again. You can imagine what the state of his hands must have been like. It must have been bloody, right? He did this an estimated 100 times. So when he was put up for his award for the Medal of Honor, his commanding officer, who I think he was one of the people he'd rescued, and ironically, one of the people that was hectoring and bullying him in training camp, they put him up for a Medal of Honor, citing that he saved at least 100 soldiers in the fashion I just described. Go out there, find a still living, wounded American soldier, bring him to the edge of the cliff, tie a knot around him, lower him down to the ground. And doing all this, without getting killed in the process. No weapons, no firearms. Often as not, he carried these wounded soldiers, a fireman's carry, over his shoulder. Sometimes he dragged them, sometimes he, he helped them to walk, hobble, but one way or the other, he got them to the edge of the cliff and then he lowered them down. Now, Desmond Doss, to his credit, said, "Nah, I only saved about 50 people," right? Even though others say he saved more like 100 people. So they divided it down the middle. Okay, we'll say you saved 75 people and give you the Medal of Honor anyway. So Desmond Doss is officially credited with saving 75 fellow soldiers. Now stop and think about that, folks. How many of those self-righteous, oh, he's invoking Enki, Enki, Enki out there, how many of them have gone out and saved 75 people, thereby ensuring the creation of dozens of future bloodlines, future generations? Desmond Doss is literally responsible for bringing into existence hundreds, if not thousands, of people, because some of those soldiers that he rescued would have had children, would have, and whose children would have had children, so on and so forth. You know what a lesser man would have done? A lesser man would have come across one of these wounded soldiers and say, "Look at you. You bullied me in training camp. You called me names. You made fun of my religion. Now you're lying there bleeding. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go hide in these rocks. And when the Japanese come, I'm gonna watch as they use you for bayonet practice. And just know that I'll be laughing, laughing." Didn't happen that way. Didn't matter that these guys bullied him. Didn't matter that they made fun of him. Didn't matter that they called him a coward and wished he was dead and said and threatened to kill him when it came down to combat. All that was irrelevant. Now, a lesser man who'd gone through such bullying and hectoring for his beliefs, right? He would have come across one of these wounded soldiers, look down there and say, "I don't know, pal. I don't think you're going to make it." All right. So, let's give credit where credit's due. And oh, by the way, Desmond Doss was severely wounded by a Japanese grenade, and he was also shot by a Japanese sniper. Okay. So, it wasn't like he came out of this ordeal unscathed. The bottom line was Desmond Doss stuck by his convictions. He didn't compromise. He didn't knuckle under. He didn't care if he was ostracized. He didn't care if his fellow soldiers despised him and hated his guts. What's that got to do when it comes to his convictions? And again, to all those people out there, oh, he's invoking God, he's invoking this patriarchal religion, he's invoking Enki. What have you done lately? Talk's cheap. Action speaks louder than words. I'd rather hang around a Christian who is a true heart-centered Christian and walks the walk and not just talks the talk than be around these self-righteous esoteric freaks, right? So Desmond Doss, look him up. I'm gonna order the book about him sometime soon. Another person I want to talk about that stuck by his convictions, his beliefs, did not compromise, was the man the Romans referred to as Arminius, and who the Germans to this day refer to as Hermann. Arminius was part of the Cherusci tribe in Germany, Germania, the Romans called it. And he was a noble in the Cherusci tribe, and he was an auxiliary. An auxiliary for the Roman armies was usually a foreign-born soldier, a barbarian, if you will, whose chieftain had thrown in his lot with the Romans, either through bribery, coercion, intimidation, whatever the case may be. The Romans were experts at the old divide and conquer thing. And so these chieftains would promise to provide X number of warriors to fight alongside the Roman legions. And these foreign soldiers were known as auxiliaries. And oftentimes, auxiliaries would be cavalry detachments in some cases, because they would be, some of these native tribes are very good horsemen, and that wasn't really one of the things that the Romans were noted for. So they availed themselves of whatever skills were available from all the different tribes they conquered. And so a lot of the auxiliaries would be cavalry detachments, or they would be arranged in cohorts, where these are foot soldiers, but commanded by Roman officers, centurions, optios, etc. And, after about 25 years of service as an auxiliary, if they survived that long, and then, if they were lucky, they'd be granted Roman citizenship. Now, Arminius had already risen to equestrian rank, which is a very high rank indeed, because he was looked at from like a table of organization standpoint. He'd be right up there, with like a Roman noble, except he wasn't Roman, right? And he lived a good life. He was looked upon by a lot of his native tribesmen as being a traitor, a turncoat, because he worked for the Romans, was an officer working in the Roman army. He commanded his own unit of fellow tribesmen. He was living the good life. He was thoroughly Romanized by all outward appearances, and he spoke Latin. And he could have taken the path of least resistance. You know what? I'm living the good life. I can go and kick back in these Roman baths. I could be waited on hand and foot by these servants and servant girls, and I could drink of the finest wine, and I could, just live the good life. And he could have done that, and no one would have said a word. Sure, they still would have grumbled behind his back. Oh, Arminius the traitor, he's even calling himself by the Roman name these days instead of just plain old Herman. But Arminius had a plan, and Arminius' plan was to learn everything he could about the Roman army by joining the Roman army, essentially. And so down the line, years down the track, he would covertly arrange a truce and a secret agreement with not only within his own Cherusci tribe, but within a number of other German tribes, some of whom have a past history of hostility to his own Cherusci tribe. Now you can imagine these chieftains from other German tribes. Wait a minute, dude. It's like you've been working for the Romans all this time. Now you come rocking up and say, oh, you've got this plan to, lead three Roman legions into a forest and annihilate them, right? Look, I was born at night, but not last night. You could be leading us into a trap, right? And these would be valid concerns because, again, this guy seems to be thoroughly Romanized. The Romans love him. The Roman governor in Germania, Verus, implicitly trusted Arminius. And again, Arminius could have taken the path of least resistance. He could have just said, oh, I'm no longer a Cherusci. I'm no longer a German. I'm just going to live the good life. This is as good as it gets. I'm looking out for numero uno. But Arminius slash Herman had a plan, like I alluded to a moment ago. He wanted to learn everything about Roman tactics, Roman strategy, Roman battle order, Roman formations, Roman leadership. Arminius bided his time. Remember, a lot of people in the different Germanic tribes thought he was a traitor, thought he was a turncoat, openly contemptuous of him when he'd rock up with his Cherusci tribesmen in their uniforms, in their outfits, working for the Romans. And remember also, there was a lot of intertribal rivalry, intertribal hostility between the Cherusci and other tribes, going back, you know, a long time. So there was no love lost between some of these other Germanic tribes and the Cherusci. But Arminius continued to play the game. He continued to curry favor with the Romans. He worked his way, wormed his way, into the confidence of Verus, the Roman general who was in command of 3 Roman legions in Germania. He became a trusted confidant of Verus. And what happened was, over time, and remember the tremendous risk Arminius was putting himself, his tribe, all of his confidants, and the families, if the Romans got wind of the fact that he was plotting to annihilate them, it would have been curtains for him. He'd be lucky if they just ran him through with a sword rather than being crucified. So, at tremendous risk to himself, he went around to the various chieftains. First, he had to convince the people in his own tribe, look, I got this plan. Okay, the Romans trust me now. I've worked with them for years. I know all their tactics. And we know the lay of the land. We know how the forest is laid out. We know where we can bring them in to ambush them on all sides. We know where we can bring them in where there is no hope of escape for the lot of them. He had to go around, first convince his own tribe, and then go to all the other tribal elders and chieftains and convince them to go along with it. No mean feat, but he did. Over time. And then what he did was, knowing that Verus was going to move his 3 legions to a different part of Germany, he conned Verus into allowing him, Arminius, to show a different path through the forest, through the Teutoburg Forest. Now, prior to this, all the Germanic tribes involved had built earthworks on either side of this narrow trail. Okay, think of this very big, dark forest. In many places, you can't even see the sky because of the overhead canopy. We're talking dense forest, dark, foreboding. The Romans were a very superstitious people. And on either side of the narrow trail through which Arminius intended to lead, you know, with his cavalry, lead the Romans through. On either side, the Germans had built fortifications. They built earthen ramparts from which on either side they can hurl projectiles, stones, spears. And then, when the time was right, you know, come down on either side of the trail and attack the Roman formation strung out in a long column. And what they would do was, they would let a Roman column, whether it was a cohort or a larger formation, get isolated, get into the woods, and then, you know, when there was no hope of support from the columns in front or the column behind, and then they would just descend upon the Romans. They would come in from all sides, spears, rocks, everything, arrows flying in from all over the place. And the Romans, used to fighting in formations, used to fighting in a shield wall, used to making abrupt formation changes on command, were powerless to do any of that. They were confined. And Verus was led into this forest through some ruse or other, and then when the time was right, when the Romans were fully committed in this forest, all along the length of it, they began to get attacked. Their columns, front all the way to the very rear, began to get harassed and attacked from all sides. There was no escape. And the Germans were very tall, strong, muscular. Many of them wielded blunt-edged weapons. We often think of, you know, sword fighting and whatnot, but remember, just as nowadays, they're trying to push gun control, and they're even pushing the knife meme. Oh, you know, someone wielded a knife and did all this stuff. And sometimes that's true, and sometimes that's just hyped on the media. The Romans exerted weapons control. They didn't allow everyone to have swords and arrows and bows and arrows and whatnot. So many of the German warriors had to resort to blunt edge weapons, clubs, that kind of thing. Blunt force trauma. Once the Romans were thoroughly committed into this forest, Arminius and his cohort of cavalrymen, German cavalrymen from the Cherusci tribe, they did a disappearing act. See ya, wouldn't want to be ya. And so they left the Romans high and dry, and then all the Germanic tribes took it in their turn to just annihilate the Romans. And only a very few Romans survived. The surviving Romans that were captured by the Germanic tribes, the officers were placed in wicker basket cages and burned alive. And remember that the Germans were into human sacrifice, so they would ritually murder a lot of these Roman soldiers and officers. And then their skulls would be like nailed into trees and whatnot. When Germanicus, who was a member of the royal family, led a punitive expedition back into Germany several years later to avenge what had happened, with the three Roman legions getting wiped out by Arminius and his Germans, they found just all kinds of corpses and all kinds of skulls, you know, nailed and on the trees and whatnot. And it was just a horrific scene, you can imagine. But the bottom line is, Arminius played the game. He could have lived a good life. This is as good as it's going to get. You know what? It's like, why rock the boat? Sure, I'm really a German. Sure, all the other Germans think I'm a traitor and they hate me. But I've got a plan. I've been with them, with the Romans for decades now. They trust me. I know their tactics, and I know that fool Verus, their governor general, I know him inside out. I've got him under my thumb. Okay? So the bottom line is, Arminius is yet another person who did not compromise. He did not stop being a German. He did not stop being true to himself, true to his people. He submerged outwardly his undying hatred for the Romans. Tired of their taxation, tired of their oppression, tired of their manipulation, tired of their bully boy tactics. But he played the game. He worked for them. Stop and think about this, the kind of commitment we're talking about. And it resulted in the, not really the battle of the Teutoburg Forest, more like the annihilation of three Roman legions in the Teutoburg Forest in 9 AD. And when word finally got back to Augustus, Augustus was known to be just running around frantically in his imperial palace screaming, "Verus, where are my eagles? Where are my eagles?" Each legion had its own standard, which was a big eagle, along with the Roman numerals for that particular legion. And it was considered a disgrace for a legion to allow its standards, its eagle, to be captured or taken away by the enemy. And for three entire legions to be wiped out and their standards, their eagles, taken away by the Germans, that was a humiliation for the Romans. And aside from Germanicus's excursion, leading a punitive expedition for revenge purposes later, and eventually Germanicus was assassinated because he was one of the people in line to eventually succeed Augustus. And the Germans pretty much stayed in control in Germany. Oh, they had their tribal warfare amongst themselves now and then, and raids and counter-raids, stealing each other's cattle and stealing each other's women, etc., etc. But the Rhine River, the Rhenus, is what the Romans in Latin called it, that became the barrier. That became the demarcation zone. The Romans thereafter, aside from Germanicus' expedition, several years after the annihilation of the three legions, they never really went back. And the Roman apologist and the Roman historian said, oh, well, the reason we never went back is, you know, there's nothing really there, you know, in Germany. There's no minerals there. There's nothing really to be gained by us being there, which is nonsense. The reason they never went back and stayed is because, well, the Germans kicked them out, basically, okay? And that changed history for a long time, okay? And again, because one man, Arminius, stood by his convictions, put up with the humiliation, put up with the abuse, put up with being called a coward and a traitor by his fellow Germans. He bided his time, he played the game, and when the time was right, he led three Roman legions into a trap and annihilated them, okay? Anyway, Arminius, known as Hermann to the Germans, and you know what? I like to think that the spirit of Arminius still lives amongst the German people. They have been so abused, the German people, so demonized. You look at all the false flag terrorism of the 60s and the 70s, and then now the endless nightmare of the immigrant rape invasion. It's just horrible what's happened to the German people. General Patton was saying over and over, and this even escaped the censors, you know, when his diary was published, right? Heavily redacted, heavily censored, but still a lot of the comments he wrote in there stayed. And he said, you know, we're in so many words, he said, we're destroying, you know, the only real civilized people in Europe. And I know that's going to piss off a lot of French and people like that, but, you know, Patton had an affinity for the French. He spoke French and he liked French people, but, you know, he had a lot of respect for the Germans too. And his outspokenness led to him being assassinated. But I like to think that the spirit of Arminius lives. And I like to think that at some point, you know, the German people will just rise up and just say, no mas, no more. We're not putting up with this. And that's what happens with gun control, folks. You know, that's what happens when you take away the guns from the people, and then you can flood in all these, you know, raping immigrants who resolutely do not want to integrate. Instead, they want to bring in their culture, their mores, their ethics into the country, which they parasitically will then prey upon, right? So here's to the spirit of Arminius. Modern-day Germany and modern-day Germans. Don't forget your heritage. And stand up and be proud of who you are. The person I'm going to talk about next, who also stood by his convictions, was Charles de Gaulle, another very interesting figure in history. De Gaulle was a proponent of armored warfare. He was not the first proponent of that. In France, that honor went to an individual by the name of Colonel, later General, Estienne, who in the early 1920s proposed the concept of artillery d'assaut, or assault artillery, and he wanted to push this notion of what we now know as tank warfare. De Gaulle, in World War II, prior to World War II, kept pushing for independent use of armored vehicles en masse, not as a support for infantry and as a support for defensive works, but for offensive operations. En masse, utilized, well, much the same way the Germans later showed. The Germans got a lot of their ideas, quite frankly, from the Russians. They had a secret treaty, the Germans and the Soviets did, where the Germans learned the concept, and this training all went on in Soviet Russia and Soviet Union. Of the deep battle as employed by the Mongols, and the leading Russian-Soviet theoreticians, they adapted that Mongol form of mobility warfare, mobile warfare, and adapted it to their own armored warfare. Unfortunately for the Soviet Army, in one of Stalin's purges, he wiped out a lot of the top generals and colonels who were proponents of this form of warfare. So that really handicapped the Russians, the Soviets, rather. I keep saying that for at least the first several months of the war. They adapted quite quickly, though. It's a long story, but the top Russian general, I keep saying Russian, I'm sorry, Soviet general Tukhachevsky, who was a proponent of this armored mobility warfare based on the Mongol model, he was liquidated by Stalin as a result of a counterintelligence ploy by the German SD, Sicherheitsdienst, German SS Foreign Intelligence. They hatched this plot to make Stalin think that Tukhachevsky was planning to remove Stalin in a coup, oust him in a coup. And so Stalin, being the paranoid, spiteful reptile that he was, got rid of Tukhachevsky and all of Tukhachevsky's colleagues, underlings, people who believe in the same form of warfare as Tukhachevsky, and that really backfired on the Soviets later. Whole long story there. But getting back to France for a long time had been wedded to this Maginot Line defensive warfare mindset, which hindered them all the way to their involvement in Indochina when they were desperately hanging on to their colonial possession in Indochina, what we now know as Vietnam. That whole area, Laos, etc. This concept of the French building all these forts all over the place, right? Instead of offensive warfare. And de Gaulle was a proponent of that. The French hierarchy, the French military, looked at de Gaulle and others like him as being basically crazy, because that's not their conception of warfare. And de Gaulle was certainly by no means the only one who proposed this. There were others. Major General JFC Fuller, a British general, interestingly enough, also a Aleister Crowley initiate, go figure, was an early proponent of mobile armored warfare. His colleague, Colonel B.H. Liddell Hart, also of the British Army, a historian, also were proponents of armored mobile warfare, and as was Charles de Gaulle. So when the time came, when the Germans attacked France, and the Germans were in the the French declared war and the British declared war on Germany. Always remember that, okay? So from a professional military standpoint, the attack was the only thing the Germans could have done, rather than wait for the combined forces of the British and the French and the Belgians and whoever to attack. The Germans did the only thing that made sense to them. They attacked France, and de Gaulle was the one of the few commanders who actually had an impact in that German attack by his use of mass armored warfare, mass tanks. He actually, had a tactical victory over the German army at a certain point, and caused even the German high command, who wanted to slow things down, Guderian's advance into France. So he proved that his concepts were valid, that if you use armor en masse and not tie it down to infantry necessarily, use infantry as an adjunct to armor instead of armor always being an adjunct to infantry, then you can actually make progress. And Guderian, the great German commander, was a proponent of this as well. A punch with a closed fist rather than, fingers extended in all directions, thereby diminishing your strength in the sense of armored warfare. Okay, so de Gaulle showed himself as someone who was an iconoclast, as someone who stuck to his convictions, as someone who believed in what he was doing. And after the French armistice, when the Vichy government yielded to the Germans, really had no choice in the matter, and all French soldiers and officers were to surrender their arms and, basically go back to peaceful pursuits, but under German control, Charles de Gaulle said, no, ain't gonna do it. I'm gonna go to England. I'm gonna start my own free French movement. And that's what he did. And as far as the Americans and the British were concerned, de Gaulle became a royal pain in the neck because he always wanted to restore the honor of France. He always wanted the other countries, the so-called allies, to regard France as an equal member, not a junior member, not a country that knuckled under. Because remember that the French army largely fought in World War I terms, hiding behind their Maginot Line, not believing in armored mobile warfare, de Gaulle being one of the few who did. So de Gaulle said, no, I'm going to start my own free French movement. And he always demanded that France be regarded as an equal. And often as not, the Americans and the British, especially Churchill, they looked down their nose at de Gaulle, right? They saw him as an irritant. They thought he was in the way. There were even allegations that the Americans and or the British plotted to assassinate de Gaulle during World War II because, you know, of all, from their standpoint, all these strident demands he kept making, right? But, you know, he was only doing what he felt was right for his people. He set up his own intelligence organization in the Free French Movement, and he gave these radio broadcasts to occupied France. And eventually, of course, you know, the outcome. France was liberated. And then eventually down the line, de Gaulle became president of France. Now, again, de Gaulle did not want to see France viewed upon as a junior member of the then new NATO alliance. He wanted France to be regarded as an equal. And he even threatened at times to, you know, work to collaborate with the USSR. And he wanted France to be a nuclear power. For a brief time after World War II, de Gaulle was Prime Minister of France until all the political infighting and all the, what I now understand to be, you know, communist subversion, all that stuff, led him to just quit. In disgust, he went into so-called political wilderness, was not involved, at least overtly, in politics for 12 years. Finally, 1958 rolls around, and France is in a state of turmoil. The Algerians are demanding independence. The colonists who are French in Algeria, they want to be protected. They want their rights maintained. The French army in Algeria starts to agitate to want to bring de Gaulle back to power. They even threaten to drop paratroopers on Paris, you know, to force the return of de Gaulle. Actually, what happened also, French paratroopers from Algeria actually landed on the island of Corsica, the birthplace of Napoleon, and they took it over, right? So all this was going on. Pretty much a state of national emergency was in the works, and so out of the political wilderness comes Charles de Gaulle, General Charles de Gaulle, to try to restore order. And he immediately sets about to try to rectify things both domestically and also in Algeria. You must remember also that the French had recently pulled out of Indochina after the humiliating defeat at Dien Bien Phu, 1954, if memory serves. May 1954, you know, so from the French military army perspective, they've known nothing but a series of defeats and humiliations going back friggin' decades. I mean, you got to go back to, you know, the halcyon days of Napoleon's empire. But when you can look back and say France was a true military power that was not only respected but feared, right? And so you have the horrific stalemate of World War I, all banker Rothschild manipulated World War I, as was World War II. And then you have their humiliation of World War II, the Germans rapidly taking over France, Guderian's tank corps capturing like 250,000 French soldiers at one go. And then you have the French trying to hang on to Indochina, right? Vietnam. That doesn't work out. They get ousted in May 1954. A lot of their soldiers wind up in cages. About the only thing the French military really did good was traffic narcotics, actually, when you think about it. Operation X, I think it was called. The major drug heroin operation out of Indochina. So the French military wanted to hang on to Algeria. And look at the long colonial involvement that the French military, the French had in North Africa. Right, the Foreign Legion was basically born in North Africa. So the army thinks that if we bring de Gaulle back, he's an old army guy. He's gonna do what we want, right? He's gonna do what we expect. He's gonna keep Algeria for France. He's gonna look out for the interests of the colons, the colonists who've lived there for generations. Okay, these are French people that have lived in Algeria for generations. And had no intention of leaving. And what the French military did was they launched this dirty war against the Algerian resistance, the Algerian freedom fighters, if you will. And there was atrocities on both sides. The French military meeting out horrific mass reprisals, right? They did the same thing in Indochina, where they would just have their naval vessels open fire on civilians, basically, just shell them unmercifully. So, the French always had that mindset. And you go back to the days of Napoleon, if not before. I mean, the French army, they really meted out atrocities to civilians in warfare. That's just been their modus operandi for all that time. So, what happens? De Gaulle takes a look at France, and eventually, what he decides upon was to give the Algerians Algeria back, right? So the French army, the military, they feel like they've been stabbed in the back, and they form a secret organization, the OAS, the Secret Army Organization, which attempts to assassinate de Gaulle on several occasions. The French Foreign Legion was disbanded by de Gaulle. It took a long time for the Foreign Legion to be restored, right? And basically, any of the elements that were against giving the Algerians independence and had developed this animus towards de Gaulle for giving Algeria back, right? They were disbanded. And it was like it created almost a civil war in France. So the point of relevance is that, yes, de Gaulle had to do what was right by the colons, the French. Colonists in Algeria who'd been there for decades, generations. He had to do what was right by them. Nowadays, the cultural Marxists are screaming, "Oh, de Gaulle was racist because he didn't rescue. He only rescued the French nationals out of Algeria. He only got them out. He didn't bother to get the Algerians out who helped the French and who were hunted down unmercifully by the French Algerian nationalists." You know what? That's just trying to besmirch the name of de Gaulle. De Gaulle's primary responsibility was to help the French people. I mean, you just think about all the people trying to jump onto planes when Saigon fell and how the US military turned their back on them, right? You think of the US military turning their back on the Montagnard tribesmen that helped them fight against the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, etc., etc. This kind of betrayal goes on all the time. So for them to scream, these cultural Marxists nowadays, "Oh, de Gaulle only cared about the French, he's a racist, yada, yada, yada," that doesn't hold any water. But getting back to the point about, not compromising, right? And I'm cutting a lot of corners. It may come off as a simplistic generalization. I don't have the time to go into all the details about the dirty war in Algeria and all that. But the bottom line is, as far as de Gaulle was concerned, just as he was resolute and he would not surrender to the Germans under the terms of the Vichy government, right? And just as he wouldn't knuckle under to the French puppet general, who was established by the Allies in World War II, Giraud, right? He created his own separate organization, separate from Giraud. Just as he stood firm against all the manipulation, all the backstabbing, and even the supposed assassination attempts against De Gaulle during World War II by the good guy Americans and British. And later, when he comes back from the political wilderness after being out of the game for 12 years, France is in turmoil, Algeria wants independence, the French army wants him back because they figure, okay, De Gaulle is one of us, he's going to let us keep Algeria. In fact, he'll send more reinforcements so we can finally put down these troublesome Algerians. No, he says, and this coming on the heels of Indochina, remember the France's humiliating withdrawal out of Indochina. De Gaulle says, no, we're going to grant Algeria independence, and man, the defecation hit the oscillation. In fact, there were so many assassination attempts on de Gaulle, and that he somehow survived them all, that this spy novel movie was made, The Day of the Jackal. It was based on all the attempts by the OAS, made up of these disaffected, largely French paratroops, some foreign legion members and regular army in Algeria and in France, who were against de Gaulle giving Algeria back to the Algerians. He stood firm. He said, no, we don't need to be there. We don't need to be in Algeria. We're going to do what's right. We're going to get our people out. We're going to grant them independence, and we're going to move on. So he stood by his convictions. He stood by his beliefs. He didn't knuckle under. And, with the benefit of hindsight, was it right? Was it wrong? At the time, he felt it was right. And he stood by his convictions. And so that's my message to you folks today, is whatever your beliefs are, whatever your convictions are, stand by them. If it's your internal compass, if it's your internal guidance mechanism prompting you to have these views and beliefs and convictions, stand by them. Stick to your guns. Believe in yourself. And don't let others influence you in any way. Because in the end, you're the only one that has to answer to yourself. So I thought I'd have this little discussion here about compromises, people who didn't compromise. Desmond Doss, Arminius, Charles de Gaulle. Okay? In the member section, I'm going to talk about alternate realities, not only in a MyLab sense, but also from the standpoint of from an oversoul perspective, because I believe that certain people like Diaphim, you heard her on one of my interviews, one of the people I interviewed recently, she talks about some of these ops she's been on, which either were in this reality or in another reality. And I think that some people, they have it within their genetic makeup. They have this ability, innate ability to go in and out of different dimensions, in and out of different realities, in and out of different planes, travel forward and back in time. They just have this innate ability. It's locked within their morphogenetic code, morphogenetic field. And I think that the oversoul plays a role in this, because not only my labs are being prompted to do these ops by their my lab controllers, but these ops are being done in on a standalone basis, where the people are just doing this, and I'm going to cite some examples from what I've heard over the years. Anyway, you've been listening to Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you in part two for the member section.